These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Policymakers in almost every state last year dove into what's called net metering. It's a geeky-sounding alternative energy arrangement under which, if you've got solar panels on your roof, you can sell the excess power you generate back to your local utility, sometimes at a pretty generous price. New Hampshire was among the states that changed its net metering approach in 2016, raising the cap on the number of megawatts allowed under this program from 50 to 100. Doubling it sounds like a lot, but some states allow much, much more, while others have no cap at all. Meanwhile, the debate is far from settled in the Granite State, with the Public Utilities Commission and the legislature now weighing in. What's next for net metering is the topic today in The Exchange, and let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have three guests for the hour. Jack Ruderman is here, Director of Community Initiatives for Revision Energy, a solar energy company. Jack, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks, Laura. Good to be back.
Also with us, Rick Lebreck, Manager of Distributed Generation for Eversource in New Hampshire. Rick, thank you very much.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
And also with us, Sam Evans-Brown, host of Outside In, our show about the natural world and how we use it. Check out Sam's recent episode on net metering. It's called The Accidental History of Solar Power. And Sam, as always, thanks for helping us out.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, Sam, let's just start with the basics. How does net metering work? And let's just bring it down to the average Joe or Jane Granite Stater who threw up a couple solar panels on their roof.
Yeah, so I, in fact, did do just that. I threw some solar panels on my roof. So if you were to go to my house right now, in the morning when I got up this morning and there was no sun on those panels, my refrigerator was running. I turned some lights on because the sun wasn't up yet. So while all of that electricity was being used, I was importing electricity from the grid and my meter was running forwards. So if you were to go out and look at, you know, the spinning disk or the numbers counting, they would be counting up. However, now I'm here at work. You know, the refrigerator is still running, but nothing else is going on at the house. You know, sun's hitting the panels. It's probably generating more than what the house is using. And so the house is exporting electricity back onto the grid. And if you were to go out and look at the meter, the little disk would be running backwards and the numbers would be counting down. And that one-to-one exchange is the basis of net metering. It's the idea that for every electron you export onto the grid, you're discounted one of the electrons that you had imported into the house. And that's net metering. And there's one more wrinkle, which is that credit that you generate, if you were to, over the course of a month, if you were to make more than you consumed.
So you exported more than you imported.
Right. You could bank that credit towards the next month, and you can carry those credits all throughout the year. So you can effectively use a credit that you generate in the summer to offset extra usage that you do in the winter if you're, you know, not generating as much at that time.
I like the analogy of import-export. I think that makes it really easy for people to understand.
Well, that's what's going on.
Yeah, right. So where did this idea come from, Sam, in your podcast that I just listened to this morning? You say that it was organic by accident and without any real thought.
Yeah, so the first net metered building was down in Quincy, Massachusetts, and it was designed by this sort of what some people have referred to as he's a father of solar energy, this guy named Stephen Strong. And he, when he was a young engineer, put a couple solar panels on the roof of a subsidized federal housing complex down in Quincy, and he did it without asking anybody's permission. He just designed the system without input from the utility, and he did it in this way that would roll the meter backwards if they're exporting and the other way if they're importing. And he told me the story of standing in the utility penthouse with the developer at the time and asking, the system's already, you know, shouldn't we call the utility? And the developer said, oh, I'll handle that. And he just flipped the switch without asking anybody's permission. And then their way of asking permission was to have a big to-do where they invited the president to come and also the utility executives who, of course, you know, when they're in front of this crowd, just sort of
praised.
Can't
say no.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Of course, we'll ask Rick Lebreck a little bit about that. But yeah,
But, so go ahead. But essentially, it was designed the way it was because of limitations of metering technology at the time. All they had was that spinning disc. You know, it can only go forwards and backwards. So how else would they credit something that was put onto a residential application?
So one more question for you, Sam, and then I do want to bring our other guests in. The debate that we're having now, why is wholesale versus retail price so important? I mean, what you described earlier sounds so simple. You know, sometimes Sam is exporting power to the grid. Sometimes he's importing it. Whatever he nets, he's able to credit towards another time when he needs it. So why are people arguing so much about this?
Well, the trick is that if you look at your bill, there are two halves to your bill, right? You've got it breaks down to the cost of the energy that is flowing across the poles and wires and also the cost of the poles and the wires themselves. You've got the distribution grid and the transmission grid that brings power over long distances. And when your meter runs backwards, you're getting credited for both halves of that bill. So you're being reimbursed also for the cost of the poles and wires. So even
which
though
you had nothing to do with.
Exactly. And eventually, you know, if you were to imagine a world in which every single customer were to have solar panels on their roof, which of course is impossible because not everyone faces south, not everyone has a suitable roof. But if you were to imagine that world, the utilities would go bankrupt. I mean, they would be getting no revenue under the net metering system. And, you know, that might be somewhat of an exaggeration of what would actually occur. And that's sort of the debate that we're having today.
Well, and let's talk about that, Rick. And I have read that, you know, many utilities fear that if net metering expands too much, if solar expands too much, it could be the start of this so-called death spiral that Sam describes, where fewer and fewer people are paying for a greater share of maintaining the grid, those non-solar people. I mean, is it that stark for you?
I wouldn't call it a death spiral. I think the utilities and the regulators will always find a way to make solar customers coexist with non-solar customers. So it is true that as the amount of solar, the amount of customers taking advantage of solar continues to grow, this erosion of revenue collection where the solar customers aren't contributing adequately, you know, at least in the opinion of the utilities, to the cost of service, to the cost of delivering that power to them. As that continues to grow, the utilities' expenses don't shrink. We still have this vast delivery infrastructure of poles and wires and substations and trucks and human resources and accounting systems and whatnot. The costs are not going down, but the revenues are. So the regulators and the utilities would have to file for increases in rates. You know, we can't be in a continuous cash negative situation. So in order to make up for that mismatch between revenues and expenses, we'd have to ask for an increase in rates. And that increase in rates would apply to all customers. And since solar customers are netting to zero, basically, in many months, it would disproportionately affect non-solar customers. So as this, we call it a cost shift or a cross-subsidy where non-solar customers' rates have to go up to compensate for solar customers getting retail credit for what is really a wholesale product.
So again, the infrastructure, the grid, the poles, the wires, you know, all that has to stay there and get paid for.
Yeah, very, very little of that infrastructure varies with usage, and at least in residential customer rate design at the moment, the bulk of our costs are recovered through we call it a volumetric charge, a kilowatt hour charge, if you will. So the more power you consume, the more revenue, the higher your bill is. But most of the utility delivery infrastructure is fixed assets. And so there is no variation with kilowatt hours.
Well, and Jack, to you, one supporter wrote recently that, quote, net metering has long been the foundation of rooftop solar economics in the U.S., going on to say that if net metering went away or was severely limited, solar companies will have to shut down. So is that your death spiral?
It's not a death spiral, but it would be unfair and it would be damaging to the industry. And the reason that I say it would be unfair is that what Rick is talking about, all these costs, that may be true 15 years from now or 20 years from now when we have a lot of solar spread throughout the entire state. But Right now, we're in the middle of a docket at the New Hampshire Public Utilities Commission. The legislature passed a law last session which said to the PUC, please look at and examine net metering rates and determine if they are fair and just and reasonable and determine whether or not there is any cost shift going on. So we now have over 1,000 pages of pre-filed testimony in that case, a lot of expert testimony on both sides of the issue. And staff at the PUC is a neutral party that's charged with advising the commission. What's the story here? Is this a big subsidy that's going on? Is it a cost or a loss of revenue to the utility? Are the non-solar customers subsidizing the solar customers? And what they found in 165 pages of testimony that was filed by an independent consultant hired by the PUC is that right now there is no data to prove that theory, the theory of cost shifting. And
from non-solar to solar.
Exactly. There is no data, there is no evidence. And that follows very closely on a decision from Massachusetts where the exact same scenario played out. National Grid came in and said, we want more money or we want to change net metering rates because we're losing money and it's unfair. They had a very exhaustive fact-finding process and the result was no evidence of a cost shift. We completely agree with what Sam is saying. If we get to a point where we have 10, 20, 30 times the amount of solar that we now do, this is an issue that we'll need to talk about and look at carefully. But right now, the way the utilities are looking at it, they're only seeing one side of the ledger. They're looking at costs, but what they're not telling you and what they're leaving out is the benefits. When you produce local electricity that is clean, that is at the source, there are about a dozen different benefits that can be quantified. And there have been over a dozen studies called cost or value of solar studies, where the purpose is to determine what's the value of the net metered energy. And most of those studies have concluded that not only is the net metered energy worth full retail, it actually is worth more than full retail. So if any subsidy is happening, the subsidy is from those who have solar to those who don't have solar.
Wow. Okay. So that's a big difference in opinion. And we will tease that out, the costs, the benefits. You can join us, too, with your questions and comments. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And, guys, we've got a couple emails and Facebook comments that have already come in. You can join us by phone, 1-800-892-6477, or, again, email exchange@nhpr.org. And Sam, you can see you want to jump in there. Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to sort of lay out why it might be that solar does create some benefits to the system as a whole, why it might be that me having solar panels on my roof might actually be saving my neighbor some money.
Your non-solar neighbor.
Exactly. And so to understand this, there's sort of two concepts that you need to understand. First is that the way the grid is designed, it's almost like you had have a highway system, except that highway system can never have any traffic on it. So if it has a traffic jam, the whole grid might crash, right? So they design it so that, you know, there's 48 lanes of traffic so that the on that highest peak moment where everyone's trying to get out of town to go to, you know, Martha's Vineyard for 4th of July or whatever, there the traffic will flow smoothly even at that peak moment. So that's the way the grid is designed. And so anything that can reduce that peak demand could, in theory, be saving money. It might not be saving money today. It might be saving money in the future when improvements have to be made as use rises. So anything that shaves that peak could save everyone money because they have to build out less, fewer poles and wires. So this has something to do with solar because solar tends to generate during those very high demand moments. For instance, a really hot summer day tends to be very sunny, tends to be the middle of August. The peak on a day like that is probably around 3 p.m. Solar might not be doing, you know, if depending on how your panels are oriented, they might not be doing 100% of their capacity, but as much as maybe a third of their capacity is what we've been hearing from the regional grid operator, will likely be reduced, be, you know, cranking out watts and reducing that demand. So in that way, it lowers the cost on the wholesale markets for the power that everyone's buying, and perhaps someday in the future could reduce the amount of upgrades the utilities have to install. The trick with that is it doesn't reduce past investment, right? If the utilities have already built transmission lines planning for some scenario 10 years in the future, that is sunk cost that solar cannot help with.
Costs that Eversource has already eaten and wants to recoup those costs. So to use your highway analogy and why this isn't just a solar versus non-solar, Sam, so there's that traffic, you know, and it's starting to bottle up on the way down to Cape Cod or whatever in the summer. And then all of a sudden, you, the solar guy, it's like you've got the James Bond car, and it turns into a helicopter, and you're out of the traffic.
Well,
you're not
causing,
you're
removing
out.
Cars from the road,
exactly.
Right? By reducing the demand coming out of that one house.
Okay, Rick's not looking very happy with our analogy here. Go ahead, Rick.
No, this is very difficult, you know, and like Jack said, there's thousands of pages of testimony on exactly these debates, and we're going to try to hash it out in the next 45 minutes. But to the point Sam just raised about the traffic jam analogy, Eversource agrees that in certain locations, on certain circuits, X number of years down the road, if you had properly sited solar resources, preferably coupled with batteries so that they could match the time of the peak, could have some level of dispatchability and control by the utility, something we could plan on, that has some value. But in this docket at the PUC, we've demonstrated, you know, we feel that the vast majority of our system at the moment, of the Eversource system, is not experiencing these traffic jams. You know, we have perhaps 5% of our capital spend for next year will be on projects designed to alleviate capacity constraints on circuits. So, and I believe we submitted data that 3 out of 49 of our higher voltage substations at the moment are even approaching a capacity limitation. So where in theory, maybe, you know, 10, 20 years down the road, if we have some sustained load growth, some targeted resources on those particular circuits might have some value to defer, delay, or eliminate the need for the utilities to make traditional utility investments, but it's really watered down and to be continuing to compensate randomly scattered rooftop solar throughout New Hampshire now at the full distribution and transmission rates in the retail bill, we feel is overcompensation.
Well, and could we just, before we go any further, I'm glad you said that, Rick, lay out the numbers. Right now, people who generate solar power and sell it back to the grid, like Sam, get 17 cents per
kilowatt hour.
How much do you think they should get?
Well, in our testimony, we threw out one argument is that generation is valued right now at ISO New England. We have a competitive marketplace for generation, and that's what these solar is a source of generation.
Yeah, that's the independent system operator that is sort of in charge of New England's power
supply. And over the last few years, the wholesale price of energy plus capacity has been in the 3, 4, 5 cents a kilowatt hour range.
So why do solar panel owners get so much more?
That's a good question.
Jack?
Because net metering is not a subsidy. It is an exchange of goods for money. And that is the value of that electricity that the solar panels are generating.
So say that again. Just spell that out really clearly for
sure.
Folks.
Sure. So when I overproduce and export my solar power onto the grid, if I am Eversource, there is a value to that electricity. It's going to end up being distributed to my neighbors and sold to my neighbors. So the question is, how much should Eversource pay for that? And we're saying the analogy to wholesale power doesn't make any sense. This isn't wholesale power. First of all, it's delivered at the source. So there is no cost to transmit it across many miles of poles and wires. There also are no line losses. Generally, you lose 7 to 8% when you generate power and send it over the wires.
It's just wasted,
it reduces
basically
wear and tear on the system, on the grid. It prevents the need for new power plants or new upgrades to infrastructure. It helps reduce peak load, and I want to touch on that for a second. It's not a matter necessarily of where it's located. Peak is peak, and when it's August and we're in the fifth day of a heat wave and utilities are struggling to bring on power, the most expensive power is at that time, and that is when solar is producing, reducing
as
that.
As Sam explains, Jack, I've got to cut you off there. I do apologize.
Good morning. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. It's 919. NHPR's award-winning website is your best source for New Hampshire news that matters. Add it to your online news bookmarks and get caught up every day at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Remick Museum and Farm Tamworth, presenting the 14th annual Ice Harvest and Winter Carnival on Saturday, February 4th, a New Hampshire tradition, remickmuseum.org. Support also comes from Vineyard Brands, importers of La Vie Farm, wines from parent family of Southern Rhone Valley, available in New Hampshire state liquor stores, rhone.net. And taking a look at the weather for today, clouds and sun, blustery. We may see a few snow showers, highs in the upper 20s north to upper 30s south. You're listening to NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, net metering. The New Hampshire Public Utilities Commission considers how much money those who use solar energy should get for selling that energy back to the grid. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter if you'd like, NHPR Exchange. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Sam Evans Brown is here, host of Outside In, our show about the natural world and how we use it. Check out his episode on net metering. It's called The Accidental History of Solar Power. Rick Lebreck is here, manager of distributed generation for Eversource in New Hampshire, along with Jack Rudiman, director of community initiatives for Revision Energy, a solar energy company. And guys, lots of emails coming in, some calls, but I did want to get your thoughts, Rick, on what Jack said just before the break. You know, he's saying it's not as simple as, you know, 17 cents versus 4 cents, that there are so many benefits that solar has for the grid overall that you seem to be saying, Jack, those should be appreciated. And Rick, I'd love to hear from you on that.
Yeah, there, in this, again, in the, referencing the docket, there have been, and across...
it's the Public Utilities Commission examining how much solar panel owners should be paid. Yeah, go ahead, Rick.
Studies have been presented that attempt to quantify the value of solar. And the utilities have provided their rebuttal of those points of view. And part of the value comes from environmental attributes, and no one can debate that solar has positive benefits on the environment. The rebuttal that the utilities have for that point of view is that the environmental attributes of solar are compensated for through federal 30% income tax credit. There's New Hampshire PUC rebates that have been set aside that are funded by utility customers to benefit these renewable energy programs. And there's a renewable portfolio standard whereby customers and solar project owners can get renewable energy certificates. So there's some significant subsidy and incentive programs already that are designed solely to compensate for the environmental characteristics. So when you strip that away, you're really talking about the energy production, the capacity value, and as we were talking about before the break, whether or not there's any avoided distribution or transmission expenses.
Sam, real quick, and then we'll go to our listeners.
I was just going to say there's something that Rick said earlier that I really think bears repeating, which is that the benefits to the grid, if we're talking about all the benefits that Jack was talking about, vary greatly depending on the location in which solar is installed. So a good example is if you were in a neighborhood that had a lot of commercial things, you know, retail stores, there'd be a lot of load on that circuit during during the middle of the day, during those peak hours, versus if you're on a circuit that was mostly residential homes where people are at work during the day and then come home in the evening, the peak for that circuit would be much later in the day when solar's not producing. And so the benefit would be higher on the circuit that has a lot of retail places versus on the residential.
The benefit to the grid overall. So
exactly.
To use us as an analogy, Sam, I live close to downtown. You live a little bit out in the woods.
In the woods, right?
So
I don't know how exactly the wires are configured in Concord, but that's a good example. It likely solar on your home might have more benefit to the grid than solar on my home. The question is, how do you incentivize solar to get it placed in the right place? In Vermont, they have this sort of heat map of places where the circuit is sort of overloaded with solar already versus where it could really benefit. You know, the MIT just came out with something called the Utility of the Future, where they recommended getting away from net metering and incentivizing solar in ways that encourage it to be put, you know, oriented so that it'll be generating during peak hours or placed in locations where
it'll
have more benefit. Right. It's a question. How do you reimburse solar in a way that's perhaps a little smarter and ensures that it's installed in a slightly smarter way?
Well, we should definitely talk about that more. How do we get away from net metering if it's problematic for some people? Jack, I can see you want to jump in, but lots of listeners who also want to join our conversation. So let's go to them. And Kermit's in Bedford. Hi, Kermit. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. My wife and I had initially built our home specifically with the idea that we would eventually install solar. Our ridge line is exactly east-west. The degree of our roof line is 43 degrees. And it faces due south. The big appeal to go to solar is, A, it gets us closer to 20% by I can't remember what year. And two, the real appeal for residential of net metering is the fact that we wouldn't have to install a very expensive battery system that currently is a lead acid based battery system. And it's extremely expensive to put in a battery system along with the solar. So to look at net metering as a battery system where we contribute onto the grid, at the same time we withdraw later, obviating the need for a battery system in the house.
Oh, Kermit, that's a good analogy. Jack, what do you think? Thank you for calling, Kermit.
Yeah, it's a great point. Battery technologies are becoming increasingly affordable. We're not quite there yet, but a few years down the road, we probably will be. In the meantime, rather than spend $15,000 or $20,000 on a battery storage system, you can just export it to the grid and let other customers use that electricity. So I would agree with what the caller has to say.
Yeah, go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, as a counterpoint to that, in this situation, the utility is acting as the battery. So when you talk about the value of solar to the grid, you can also talk about the value of grid to the customer. And in this case, the customer does not need to buy an expensive battery system because of net metering.
Okay, thank you for the call, Kermit. And Lewis is in Raymond. Hi, Lewis. You're on the exchange. Welcome.
Hi. My question is I'm sorry I wasn't there from the beginning, but the person representing the conventional way of having electricity, how are these compensations for these solar industries affecting us, the common people? I mean, I know people want to get their solar panels up and all of that, but the people who are not into solar, how are these compensations for the solar industry affecting us? Are we paying a lot more because of it?
Well, Lewis, thank you for the question. And everybody, I think, wants to talk about this. But Sam, you talk about this very specifically in your podcast. There's sort of an image that, you know, net metering helps middle class and wealthy people who don't really need the help.
Certainly every study that I've seen as to who is installing solar on their roofs has suggested that it's mostly people of middle and upper income classes.
Because if you're a renter, I mean, you have no control over
right.
that.
Right, but exactly the nut of the question, which is how much is that costing everyone else, is exactly what we've been talking about today. And I'd say it's a matter of great debate. And in fact, when we look at what the staff of the Public Utilities Commission said on this question, it was essentially that we don't have the data to answer it. We don't really know how much it's costing. They looked at the utilities analysis and they said that, you know, it's somewhat lacking. And they looked at what the solar companies have said. And they said, well, this is a little bit too, you know, too blue sky. So I think we don't have we don't have a number to answer that question with.
Well, and Jack, there is this image that, you know, bully for you, you can afford to get the solar panels on your home, or you live in a house where, you know, you don't have a landlord telling you what you can and cannot do. How do you advocate for this without seeming like you're trying to help people who don't really need help?
Sure. Well, I think it's a misconception that solar is elitist and only for those who are well off. Anyone can call one of the national solar companies right now and say, please come out and install solar panels in my home. And if they have a good roof, The utility will do that. Not the utility, I'm sorry.
The company.
The solar company.
Like Solar City, they do everything.
Right. They pay for the panels.
And the installation.
And the installation. And you, the consumer, see a reduction in your electric bill. That's one model. At my company, we tend to sell systems more than we tend to set them up in that sort of a configuration, because our perspective is it's a much better investment in the long run. You get all of the savings instead of a small slice of the savings. But also, it's really important to note that solar prices have come down dramatically, unbelievably, in the last 10 years. You know, you've gone from where it used to cost maybe $15 a watt. Now it's down to maybe $3 a watt. And so it is increasingly affordable. And in the future, it'll be even more affordable. And what we're really looking for now is to give people the opportunity to reduce their energy costs, to control their energy costs. And that's what solar is and distributed generation is. It's a tool for controlling your energy costs. And it's a right that we all should have, just as we all have a right right now to change all the light bulbs in our house and put in LED lamps. And if we do that, does the utility come after us and say, hey, you're not paying your share of the distribution system? No. So, you know, it's unfair to look at it and say it's just this one sort of simple analysis that only looks at costs. You have to look at the benefits as well.
Do you want to jump in, Rick, on that?
Yeah, getting back to the caller's question, I just wanted to say that the renewable energy programs enacted in New Hampshire, there is a adder to the bill to fund the renewable portfolio standard, to fund RGGI efficiency
the
programs.
The bills of everybody.
The bills of everyone.
Of, you know, so how they get
yeah,
their
so that's a policy decision, and it does affect. It's not a major contribution to the bill, but it does affect the bills. And the utilities strongly believe that at full retail compensation, there is a cost shift going on, and it will result over time in non-solar customers paying higher than bills than otherwise would be necessary.
So full retail, again, is at 17 cents, and you guys have been arguing maybe wholesale would be more fair, which is how many cents?
It fluctuates wildly
Sure. Hour
to hour,
yeah.
Month to month and year to year, but it's generally, in the last few years, been 4 or 5 cents per kilowatt hour.
Well, tons of comments are coming in, and I want to share a couple of them with you. And thank you for that call, Lewis. We appreciate the point. Here's Michael in Nashua who says, I'm listening to your program, and I'm surprised that nobody has mentioned that the state of Hawaii actually got to experience what can happen when too many people jump on the solar bandwagon under the current net metering rules. Michael says, it is my understanding that when the public utility actually had to shut down the new solar installations and any subsidies for them because the retail rates for net metering were costing them too much. That's that 17 cents we keep coming back to. Michael says, I think the tipping point is around 20 to 30% of the customers. Why not use wholesale rates or something in between? I'm so glad that Michael emailed, because we should look at other states and what's happened. Go ahead, Sam.
Yeah, Hawaii is a fascinating example of sort of where things can go. When we talk about the 17 cents that we're paying, Hawaii is paying actually something more like 40 cents a
wow.
kilowatt hour, because all of their electricity, or a huge amount of their electricity, is generated from oil, which has to come in tankers from, you know, over the ocean to get to them. They don't have the options that we have in terms of natural gas, in terms of burning coal, which drives up the cost of electricity there, which has indeed led to huge amounts of solar on their grid, and it is up around 20-25%, which is the point at which, as all of us have been saying, this question becomes much more of an issue. If you've got all sorts of solar panels that are all generating at the same time of day, you can in fact overload a distribution circuit if there are too many that have been placed onto that circuit, and you have to shut those panels down.
So what about better batteries, Sam? I mean, if we had fantastic batteries, who cares? Like, every house in Hawaii, my goodness, it's sunny there. Every house in Hawaii could have a solar panel. Every business, you know, every hotel.
The tariffs that Hawaii put into place, they put in two tariffs that people could choose from. One was basically a less generous version of net metering. So they gave net metering a haircut. The other was what was called a self-consumption tariff, which is to say, if you can install a battery and try to charge that battery and then use it, we will let you stay on the net metering rate for whatever overflow
more generous
there
rate.
Is. Exactly. Exactly. Yes, yes.
So did it work?
No, because batteries are still too expensive. Oh. So most people who installed afterwards opted to go for the less generous net metering rate rather than trying to install a battery, because the batteries are getting cheaper, but they have not gotten cheaper to the point where it is making sense, you know, compared to even Hawaii's rather expensive electricity.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for raising this story. And Rick, I want to ask you about it. And then Jack, I want to ask you about Nevada. That's another sort of poster child in this discussion. Go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, your listener does raise a good point that we should hit on, is that as the penetration of solar and other forms of distributed generation grow on the circuit, you know, whereas earlier we were talking about the value that might be providing in deferring or delaying typical utility projects to allow for higher customer demand, you kind of reach a tipping point where now you're actually getting to have so much solar on the circuit that you're actually causing reverse power flow. You're causing complications in utility operations, complications in utility voltage control technologies, and other issues that are going to result in higher expenses for the utilities to integrate into their systems this higher penetration of solar. So now you have an additional cost, and we can debate who should be funding the additional cost of that infrastructure as well.
So I asked Jack a little bit ago, you know, how he sort of presents himself as not just favoring wealthier people over lower income people. On your end, Rick, you know, how do you approach this issue without looking like you're trying to squelch a growing industry, a clean energy source, a sector that, by the way, is growing faster in other states and other countries than here in New Hampshire? You know, some people listening may think, too much solar? How could you possibly have too much solar? You know, people are concerned about climate change. They're concerned about air pollution. So can you really have too much solar? I mean, isn't solar just a good thing that people who care about clean air and clean energy should want?
You are pointing out the difficult position the utilities are in coming up with a position on this issue. And, you know, we've got to advocate for all of our customers, not just the solar customers. And we agree that solar is the future. It's here to stay. We'll be a big part of integrating higher and higher quantities of solar onto our system. But it's got to be done in a way that does not create economic burdens on the 98% of our customers that at the moment aren't taking advantage of solar. So it is a difficult position.
It's a disruption.
It is a disruption. But in our proposal before the PUC, we attempted to demonstrate how even at the reduced level of compensation that we were advocating for, and it wasn't the wholesale rate, we're actually proposing that exported power be compensated at the default retail energy rate. So we attempted to show that even under that structure, a homeowner could invest in solar and get a return on their investment that still makes solar an attractive choice. It's just not as attractive as under current structure.
Okay, so the example of Hawaii. I wanted to ask you, Jack, about the example of Nevada. And then I've got a couple of Facebook comments here that talk about Vermont and Massachusetts. But go ahead. Nevada is sort of the other side of this coin, isn't it, Jack?
Sure, but I do just want to comment. You know, the utilities are talking about their concern for the non-distributed gen customers, the non-solar customers. And I just want to say that I think you made a very important point, which is solar is a disruptive technology. And I think what that means to the utilities, they're not concerned so much about net metering right now. And I don't think they're so concerned about cross subsidies or cost shifting. They're concerned about 5 or 10 years from now, what happens to their business model. Solar is a threat to the business model. It is something that is going to make their shareholders unhappy, and it may shrink their revenues. And I think that is the battle that we're having here. I think it's a bit of a red herring to say right now we're concerned about cost shifts, because there is so little solar in New Hampshire relative to how much total fossil fuel and nuclear powered electric generation that we have. So I think this is more an issue about the future of the grid, people's right to control their energy costs, and the utilities being worried that the old days of having a monopoly with guaranteed returns may be threatened.
But in fairness, Jack, we need a grid.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
At least in the immediate, you know, 10, 20, 30 years. So somebody does have to pay for that.
Of course. And we're happy to pay our share as soon as we reach a level of penetration where there's so much solar that it actually can be argued that it's imposing some costs.
Like we saw in Hawaii from our emailer, Michael. Go ahead, Sam.
Just to put a finer point on this, there's also a balance that the utilities have to walk right now, which is to say, if they stamp out net metering, that what might take its place is if really cheap batteries eventually do come online, a lot of people might cut the cord and they'd find themselves in the same situation just a few years down the line.
Okay, so what's the fix? That's what we'll talk about after a break. If net metering goes away, if there's a better solution, we'll also take your questions and comments, so stay with us.
Good morning. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. It's 9:39.
I'm Joshua Johnson. On the next 1A, life as a federal employee. President Trump is cleaning house at federal agencies, getting rid of some workers who question his decisions. What does it mean for the nation if career government workers who dissent are considered disloyal? An inside look at government service under the Trump administration next time on 1A.
1A coming up next at 10 o'clock here on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Steiner Law Office, supporting Leadership New Hampshire, a 10-month program working to build a community of informed, engaged leaders. Accepting applications at leadershipnh.org. And from Milne Travel American Express, enabling people to build memories and helping nonprofits and volunteers. More information at milnetravel.com/community. Now back to The Exchange on NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're looking once again at the debate over net metering and the growth of solar power in the Granite State. Let's hear from you. Your questions, comments, concerns are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Sam Evans-Brown, Rick Lebreck, Jack Ruderman, right back to our listeners. Joel joins us from Amherst. Hi, Joel. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Laura.
Sure, go ahead.
The comment that I had has to do with whether or not this is a cost shift and whether or not that there's a subsidy going on here for rooftop solar in general. And I think the advocates of solar, and by the way, I'm a big supporter of solar. I'd love to get some on my house, but I don't have the right orientation and too many trees. But I think it's absolutely appropriate to point out that solar is not like me buying complex fluorescent light bulbs or LEDs. That's my choice. Solar on a rooftop, when it's net metered, is sold back to the utility at, right now, the retail rate. And as a customer that buys on the competitive supply side, I'm not paying 17 cents for my energy that I'm buying right now. I'm paying 7 cents from Direct Energy, a competitive supplier. I don't want my neighbor's 17 cent energy to go into my bill in any way. I've made my choice in the type of power that I'm buying, and I don't want my neighbor's choice to affect my cost.
Yeah, this is the fundamental issue. Yeah, Joel, thank you so much. Sam, we keep going back and forth in this, don't we?
Yeah, and I think, I don't know how much more I can add to the point that I'd made before, which is basically that the amount of cost shift that's going on remains uncertain, largely due to the fact that we don't have enough data on what times of day the solar that's already on the grid is producing and how much it is contributing to decreasing peak load.
So what's the fix, guys? What's the solution? If net metering raises all these concerns that our caller Joel mentions, and thank you, Joel, so much, what's a better way out, Jack?
Here's the fix. Let's get an order from the Public Utilities Commission that requires the utilities to collect the data that we need to answer the question that Sam just discussed.
If this subsidy that Joel mentions is really going on, you're doubtful that it is.
Exactly. And then secondly, let's do something about the grid. Let's modernize the grid and move to a smart grid. And let's empower customers so that if they do get a battery storage system, they can choose to sell that power back to the grid based on time of use rates. In other words, based on the value of the electricity, based on the hour of the day.
So don't pay them. I'm just trying to make this crystal clear for folks. So don't pay them that 17 cents that they're getting now. Pay them whatever it's worth on the market at that moment. And as we all know, electricity prices fluctuate wildly.
Right. So you could be getting paid more than 17 cents. You could be getting paid less than 17 cents. But you have a chance to control your energy usage. You can turn off your appliances when the power is most expensive. And you can export your battery stored electricity when it's needed most by the grid and when it's worth the most. So we really see the grid needing to be modernized. We're going to have a lot of electric cars. We're going to have a lot of electric appliances that provide heat and hot water for our homes. And what we need to do is to have an interactive two-way grid, not just a one-way grid based on the sort of 1950s design that's currently in place.
So again, if we were to make it super simple, your fix, Jack, would be better batteries and a better grid, a more modern grid. It recognizes this back and forth relationship.
Absolutely, along with better data.
Okay, what's your fix, Rick?
Yeah, Eversource is fully supportive of modern grid technologies, and there's an ongoing investigation at the PUC as well on that topic, and many of the things Jack mentioned are part of it and will be a part of the future design of the utility. But in terms of this current situation, the legislature, I believe, was in, when they enacted the bill to double the net metering cap and they sent this discussion over to the PUC, I believe they were looking for an answer, for a change in the tariff design. And we feel that
the tariff is the rate, basically.
The rate design. And we feel that the docket, while not maybe being as exhaustive as has taken place in other states, there's enough data on the record for a decision to be made here. And we think there should be, in the short term, some changes to the design of the net metering structure. We're not opposed to a customer that consumes solar power within their home, lowering their bill. But when they're sending power out to the grid that is intermittent, non-dispatchable, random in nature, and subject really to the sunshine, that there's not a heck of a lot of value there, and that should be compensated at something significantly less than it is today, and something closer to the wholesale rate of power. But in our proposal, we're suggesting the retail rate of energy as a step forward.
So one fix, and let me make sure I got this right, would be to get rid of this nice wholesale rate that solar folks get now and make it more down to what the wholesale level. I'm sorry, they get retail
now. Stripping
away
the distribution and transmission portion of the full retail rate of the 17 cents, 6 or 7 of it might be the transmission, distribution, and some other associated charges. And the energy is, you know, 9 or 10, depending upon what region you're in. That's the rate that we think. The 9 or the 10 cents a kilowatt hour, that's the rate element that we think the compensation should be based on.
Well, I love this question about fixes, because I think we're really drilling down into what's important here. And Sam, in your podcast, you called the fixes most people talk about disappointingly blunt.
Yeah, a bit of editorializing there on my part. And the reason that I find just tweaking the number to be a little blunt is that it doesn't address the factors that drive cost on the grid, which, as we talked about the highway before, the 48-lane highway out to Cape Cod. You know, if you want to reduce costs in the future on the grid, you should send some sort of price signal that lets people know when they're using electricity at a really high demand time. And this gets to the time of use rate that Jack was talking about. There's also, I mentioned before, the MIT Utility of the Future study, where they recommend going to an actual real-time rate. So what you can imagine here is that every home would have a little display on the wall that would tell you this hour, here's how much electricity costs. And that signal could then, you know, if you wanted, it could be connected to smart appliances that run themselves at times when electricity is cheap. If you didn't want, you could just use it yourself to decide when you're going to run the dryer or the dishwasher.
That makes so much sense. Oh, it's expensive now. I'll run the dishwasher, you know, before I go to bed at 11 o'clock.
And some of the folks I interviewed, you know, gave the analogy of how long distance phone calls used to be very expensive. And you'd wait until, you know, after 9 p.m. to make your long distance phone call.
Yes.
So the idea that customers, you know, are incapable of responding to those types of price signals, I think, is a little short-sighted. It might be the case that in the beginning, these real-time prices should be voluntary and they should let early adopters opt in. But it's the kind of thing that, in my opinion, people should have the ability to opt into.
Okay, I can totally, if we had that in our house, I can totally see my husband saying, stop, everybody. And I'm a little older than you, Sam, and I do remember, you know, I thought of this just the other day. I was getting ready to call a friend in another state. It was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And I remember when I was younger, you waited until 9. And if you were really, short on money, you waited until 11 o'clock to call that friend in another state. And all right, that's okay. You had to stay up late, but that's just what you did. So that's super interesting. What do you think, Jack?
I think price signals are critical. I completely agree. And again, this is something that in the staff testimony at the PUC, they are talking about the possibility of doing a pilot where people have this option, as Sam was saying, to opt in to time of use and then control their energy rates accordingly. So that's something we very much support. I don't think the utilities are quite there yet. I don't think they're ready to flip the switch on that, but I think there should be a pilot program that would make that possible.
Okay. I know one person in Concord, New Hampshire that would be so into doing that just to see what's going on and geek out about when you can run the washer or the dryer or whatever. Let's take another call. This is Bill and Lee. Hi, Bill. You're on the Exchange. Thanks for calling in. Okay. Bill, are you there? Okay, I guess Bill is gone. Let's go to Chris in Putney, Vermont. Hi, Chris. Are you on the Exchange? Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I want to thank you for this topic. This is so important. I've been living in my house off the grid for the last 8 years. And, you know, I have solar with a propane power generator backup for the long winter nights and short days. Net metering was not an option when I put the system in Vermont at all. And if it had been, I would have designed a different system. And I think that the ability to put energy back into the grid is critical long-term from a climate perspective. And I like the idea of distributed energy production. But I think that if the net metering in conjunction with a newer battery technology available, like the Tesla Powerwall kind of a thing, I think eventually we will be able to have distributed power systems that are very effective and very cost efficient.
Chris, thank you for calling in. Kind of what you were describing earlier, Jack. Do you want to jump in real quick?
Sure. I just want to mention, since the caller's from Vermont, that in Vermont they've looked at this issue and they have said when we get to a penetration level of 15%, then we have to re-examine how much solar we have. But we're going to allow net metering up to 15%. In New Hampshire, we are at about 2.5%. So I just want to point out that other states that have looked at this have concluded it's worth more than it costs up to a certain point of market penetration, and we are nowhere near those levels of penetration.
Let's take another call. This is Dave in Chester. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. My problem is I see the utility company as the evil empire. And
thank you.
I see them generating electricity with coal, natural gas, and nukes. And the environmental impact is something we're going to have to pay for in the future. And when we're paying for it in the future, anybody that's hooked up to the grid is going to have to pay. So my interest in solar is to take down the wires, not to sell anything back to them, but to be independent of them.
Okay, but not everybody has that option, Dave. So what about them?
Well, I'm worried about them because they're running antiquated nukes right in Seabrook. And they're potentially damaging the environment. They're getting natural gas from fracking, which the environmental impact of the fracking hasn't been realized yet.
Well, so there's a lot we could talk about here. But to this broader point, and I think I sort of asked you this before, Rick, but some people, including our caller, would say, look, the fuels that you guys are using now are imposing a cost on society, an environmental cost, a climate cost. So shouldn't, in this worldview, solar owners be given some thanks for that, for helping reduce those costs that we all know coal and oil are imposing on the planet?
That is a policy decision. Many states have set up their own renewable energy programs. We talked about it earlier, and there are quite a bit of subsidies out there right now to reward that type of capital investment.
But do that reward system, I think you said this earlier, not on the backs of other ratepayers. Do it in that more sort of governmental policy arena.
Well, a lot of these programs kind of are a natural fit to wind up on the electricity bill. That's the issue. You set up these programs, and they're funded by small adders to the electricity bill.
And all those small adders add up.
They do add up.
Sam?
I just want to say that I personally take issue with the idea that electric utilities are an evil empire. The grid is an enormous social good that allows us to run hospitals, allows us to run factories, allows our economy to function. And so this binary of it's renewable energy versus the utilities, I think, is damaging. And if folks perhaps thought of ways that the utilities could work to reduce their impact and how to work with the utilities in doing that, it might be a more useful framing of the issue.
Well, and there's the fundamental issue, too, of just if people are upset about utilities and costs and so forth, they could shut off the lights before they leave the house. Ahem, ahem. I'm talking about two teenagers who live in Concord. Here's a question from Anne. I think you answered part of this earlier, Jack. She just has very basic questions. All three of you can probably answer. Anne says, what percent of New Hampshire generation is now from solar, and how much more would we need to reach a level for concerns such as you discussed in Hawaii? And Jack, you said right now we're at 1%. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, there are different ways of looking at it. There's capacity versus actual generation. If you look at how much—
I think
you're
saying now. What
right,
is...
and I'm saying right now, if you look at how much of all electricity generated in New Hampshire is generated from solar, you're talking way less than 1%.
Oh, less than 1%.
It is barely measurable because solar produces about 15% of the time, if you look at a 24-hour cycle, whereas nuclear, natural gas, wood-fired plants— They're base load. They're producing power 95% of the time.
So go ahead, Rick.
Yeah, I was going to say we have about 4,000 solar customers right now, and that's about 1% of our total customer base.
Of your total customers.
Yeah.
Okay.
But as, then there are as other Jack was alluding to, on a capacity basis, the current statute, the current net metering program allows up to 100 megawatts in New Hampshire. And we'll probably get there within 2017. And that equates to about 4.5% of our peak demand in New Hampshire.
So Anne says, how much more would we need to reach a level of concern such as you discussed in Hawaii? What would you say to that, Rick?
Well, it's circuit by circuit. So if it was widely dispersed, uniformly across the state, maybe 10, 15, 20%, you can't say. It's really circuit by circuit. If you get an aggregation of solar and other sources of generation on a particular circuit, that causes concerns.
Real quickly, because we're almost out of time, but Sam, a couple folks have called in and wanted us to mention the bill in the legislature that would get rid of the cap on net metering. So some net metering folks may say, hooray, no more cap. We can produce as much as we want. But there's a catch.
Yeah, the catch is that it would reduce the rate reimbursed to solar customers down to the wholesale rate, which is what the utilities have been asking for. The effect that might have on the solar installer industry is questionable. When a similar proposal was made not quite similar, but when things like this have happened in other states, the industry has basically left the state.
Really? Yes. Left? Goodbye?
Yes. So to argue that this is a compromise, I think, is a little bit misleading. I think that bill basically proposes what the utilities would like to happen.
Well, and Anne, our emailer, asks one more legislative question. Can you mention the bill coming to the New Hampshire House next week, Sam, to eliminate the RPS? I think that's the Renewable Portfolio Standard, and how the loss of the RPS would impact this issue.
You know, I frankly think that the Renewable Portfolio Standard isn't a huge driver of residential solar installations. You know, I do sell renewable energy credits from our home, and it's about $100 a year versus the, thousands of dollars that we got from a federal tax credit. So I don't see that as a big driver. I do want to say one thing, which is that just this week we had the announcement of a commercial scale or utility scale plant in Hinsdale, New Hampshire, that is as much as 65 megawatts of solar that they'd like to build. So the residential side is only part of the story.
Well, sure. And I talked to somebody over the weekend who works for General Electric down in Massachusetts. He's in charge of their business distribution of solar. And he said it's huge. So
indeed.
We will end it there, guys. So much more we could have talked about. Jack Ruderman, good to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura.
Also, Rick LeBrecq, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Sam, thanks for helping us out. And everybody can listen to your episode on net metering. It's called The Accidental History of Solar Power. Thank you for helping us out today, Sam.
Thanks, Laura.
Well, this is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org or subscribe to our podcast. Search iTunes or Google Play for NHPR Exchange.
I'm Laura Canoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. A vote on Education Commissioner Frank Edelblut is delayed by a procedural snafu. Kelly Ayotte will lead the effort navigating the U.S. Senate for President Trump's Supreme Court nominee. And the Forest Society loses its bid to keep Northern Pass from passing through an easement. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us for The Exchange. Tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 7 p.m. on NHPR.
Good morning. You're listening to NHPR. Coming up next at 10 o'clock, it's 1A. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from the Woodstock Inn Station and Brewery, delivering the White Mountains handcrafted beer for over 20 years and a new edition, Lemon Blueberry Pale Ale. WoodstockInnNH.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at NHPR.